From the WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, poet Billy Collins. He's written poems about forgetfulness, stopping smoking, insomnia, canceled vacations, and the pictures in the Victoria's Secret catalog. We'll also hear from Sekou Sundiata, one of the most popular performance poets. He often reads accompanied by music. And film critic John Powers reviews the new comedy Rushmore, starring Bill Murray. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Billy Collins has a poem about memory, or more precisely, losing your memory, called Forgetfulness. It perfectly describes the frustrations of not being able to recall a book or a name. Billy Collins has plenty of poems that perfectly describe ordinary feelings. On this archive edition, we have an interview in which he read some of his poems. Collins has won several poetry awards. He's published in the 1992, 93, 97, 98, and the forthcoming 99 editions of the anthology Best American Poetry. He's a professor of English at Lehman College, City University of New York, and a visiting writer at Sarah Lawrence College. I spoke with him last year after the publication of his collection titled Picnic Lightning. A new edition of his 1991 collection, Questions About Angels, has just been published. That book includes the poem Forgetfulness that I mentioned. Well, Billy, I want you to read your poem Forgetfulness. I think you've described this as your Over the Rainbow poem, like one of your... Is this like your greatest hit?
It is my one hit, and I feel embarrassed about reading it so many times, but then again, I think that the Coasters never stopped singing Charlie Brown. They never got tired of that, so it is. I think it has a kind of instant appeal because it's about something that's both humorous, because we make fun of forgetfulness of, you know, people, absent-minded professors and people walking around with their glasses on their head looking for them. But at the same time, the loss of memory is frightening, and I try to handle both aspects of that.
Would you read it for us?
Sure. Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. It is as if, one by one, the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye, and you watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away, a state flower, perhaps, the address of an uncle, the capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it is not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall, well on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have even forgotten how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart.
Oh, this is the story of my life.
Anyone
I really
over,
like this poem.
Anyone over 10 can relate to that.
Oh, that's right. You know, I think it's probably particularly frightening to feel like you're losing your memory when you're a writer, because so much of your material comes from your life, which you've lived and are beginning to forget.
Indeed. And I think it often comes, it starts with books, though, I think. John Updike said that he was, I think, about halfway through this Melville novel, Redburn, I think it was, before he realized that he'd read it before. And he came to that realization because he found his own notations in the margin. So losing the library that you've spent so many years collecting in your mind is also a kind of frightening loss.
Now, the poem about forgetfulness that you just read us, do you know it by heart?
I do know that one by heart, yes.
That's good. And how did you get to memorize it? Did you have to? Is it just from having read it a lot? Or
I think it's just from having read it a lot, mm-hmm. And I think it has. Now that poetry has kind of dropped end rhyme at least and regular meter, it's much more difficult to memorize. But if I think one thing that helps you memorize a poem is the rhythmic quality of it. If it has a certain sure-footed rhythm, it's much easier to get it into your head.
One of the things I really like about your poetry is, well, how plain spoken it is in a way. I mean, it's about very ordinary experience, and it uses an ideal version of ordinary language.
I think poetic language is in fact that. It's language that is kind of tidied. It's language that's steam cleaned or purified. Language that comes under principles of organization and even neatness that are missing in certainly conversation and even in well-written prose, perhaps.
Did your poems always stick to ordinary life and always have the directness that they have, or did you ever write in other styles?
No, I wrote in awful styles when I started, mostly slavishly imitative styles.
Of who?
William Carlos Williams, Wallace Stevens, Ferlinghetti, producing really awful versions of almost unintentional parodies of these people. And it was really before I found my voice. I mean, that expression is one I'm not happy with. It sounds like it's like your voice is slipped behind the couch or something. But I think when I started to write poems that I felt only I could have written, and I think that's the point you either get to or you don't in writing poems, I felt that I had released a lot of myself into the poems, and they did become, as you said, more relaxed. They started out, at least, on very conversational notes. I think it's a sign of my overall obsession with attracting and keeping readers. I mean, all the poems have different subjects, but I think the ultimate subject of all these poems is the engagement that takes place between the poem and the reader. I don't think readers enjoy being led down a flight of stairs into an unlit basement, and that's the feeling I get from reading quite a few contemporary poems.
Well, I know exactly what you mean, and there's a lot of poems where I'll really love the beginning, and then I just totally get lost deeper in, and the imagery becomes so obscure. I might like the way the language sounds, but I have no idea sometimes what the poet is communicating.
Yes, I think there are several reasons for obscurity in poetry, and one of them is just maybe hide the banality of what's really being said. I'm not really greatly concerned with the large issue of what the audience is for American poetry, but I'm very deeply concerned about the audience for my poetry, and I try to address that concern in every poem I write, usually by starting out on some familiar note, so that the poem at least begins with something we share in common. Then I feel the poem can take the reader on an unfamiliar ride, perhaps, and take him to a place of surprise toward the end. But I really think that I'm supplying half of a possible engagement, and that the second half of that takes place in the reader's mind.
I know what you mean, and I think as a reader, one of the things I gravitate to about your poems is a sense of recognition, you know, of like, oh yeah, I know that feeling, I've had that feeling, I've experienced the forgetfulness that you're describing, I've experienced not being able to take that vacation.
I think the case might be that most of the poems that I'm writing and the ones I've been reading are of my own are not so much memory driven, but they're more conceptually driven. Not by a big concept, but maybe just by a little notion.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend not to write about my past in the way that, a kind of autobiographical way that poems would include as their kind of nervous subjects, the family or their childhoods. I guess I don't want to presume that anyone's interested in my past. I think they might be more interested in a notion that overlaps all of our experience.
There's a poem I want you to read called Asso Buco, and this is really a poem about contentment. Is contentment a difficult thing to write about?
It is nearly impossible to write about, I think. I think it's very challenging to write about because serious art, at least since the Romantics, since about the beginning of the 19th century, serious art takes sadness as a given. And I think people are very suspicious of literary works that include or center on pleasure, happiness, contentment. But of course, these things are part of our lives.
But the kind of contentment that this poem is describing, it isn't even like ecstasy or the big happiness. It's merely contentment.
It's a small bit of contentment, and I think the poem gets a little more complicated than that later on.
Why don't you read it for us?
I'd be glad to. It's called Osso Buco. I love the sound of the bone against the plate and the fortress-like look of it lying before me in a moat of risotto, the meat soft as the leg of an angel who has lived a purely airborne existence, and best of all, the secret marrow, the invaded privacy of the animal, prized out with a knife and swallowed down with cold, exhilarating wine. I am swaying now in the hour after dinner, a citizen tilted back on his chair, a creature with a full stomach, something you don't hear much about in poetry, that sanctuary of hunger and deprivation. You know, the driving rain, the boots by the door, small birds searching for berries in winter. But tonight, the lion of contentment has placed a warm, heavy paw on my chest, and I can only close my eyes and listen to the drums of woe throbbing in the distance and the sound of my wife's laughter on the telephone in the next room, the woman who cooked the savory osso buco, who pointed to show the butcher the one she wanted, she who talks to her faraway friend while I linger here at the table with a hot companionable cup of tea, feeling like one of the friendly natives, a reliable guide, maybe even the chief's favorite son. Somewhere, a man is crawling up a rocky hillside on bleeding knees and palms, an Irish penitent carrying the stone of the world in his stomach. And elsewhere, people of all nations stare at one another across a long, empty table. But here, the candles give off their warm glow, the same light that Shakespeare and Isaac Walton wrote by, the light that lit and shadowed the faces of history. Only now it plays on the blue plates, the crumpled napkins, the crossed knife and fork. In a while, one of us will go up to bed, and the other one will follow. Then we will slip below the surface of the night into miles of water, drifting down and down to the dark, soundless bottom, until the weight of dreams pulls us lower still, below the shale and layered rock, beneath the strata of hunger and pleasure, into the broken bones of the earth itself, into the marrow of the only place we know.
How did you decide to write that poem?
I think I started, I mean, I don't know where the poems are going. Most poets say that, but it does tend to be true. I think I did start with simply an attempt to write a little poem in praise of a pleasure of eating this terrific meal. I didn't know where it was going, and if there is no, I think of the poems as little journeys or little rides, if you will, as kind of cheap forms of transportation. And I like to end up in a very different place at the end of the poem than I started at the beginning. And I mean, here I start at the kitchen table and I end up kind of in the middle of the earth. So it's that kind of travel that interests me. I think it's a little like writing the poem and not knowing exactly where you're going. It's a little like driving a car at night where the headlights allow you to see ahead of yourself just so far in order to keep the thing going, but you can't see any farther than that.
My guest is poet Billy Collins. His 1991 book, Questions About Angels, has just been republished. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet Billy Collins. You're very good in your poems at describing how effortless writing sometimes can be and how difficult it could be at other times. In a poem called Tuesday, June 4th, 1991, you write, "I feel like the secretary to the morning whose only responsibility is to take down its bright, airy dictation. Until it's time to go to lunch with the other girls, all of us ordering the cottage cheese with half a pear." But then you have another poem about how hard it is to write, and I was trying to find that poem this morning, and I couldn't find it, so maybe you know the poem I'm talking about.
I'm not sure of the poem, but I think there are two. I mean, sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's hard. There's kind of a downhill poem, and there's kind of a, that does tend to write itself slightly, and then there's a very uphill poem that requires a tremendous amount of sweat. You know, it's very different for different poets. I think it's some poets, they're like, it's 90% revision. It's a little like, I compared it to what I consider the two styles of cooking. One style of cook cleans, you clean as you go along, right? You kind of dice up a carrot and then you have to clean off the board. And the other type just makes a huge mess and cleans it up later. And I think some writers want to get it right the first time. They can't proceed with the next sentence until the first one is correct. And my style is more to make a mess, just to crash through and to keep something of the spontaneity of the moment. Because the person who comes back to revise the poem is really a different person. It's like Heraclitus talking about not being able to stick your foot in the same stream twice. The person who comes back the next morning to revise or the next month to revise is a slightly different creature. And I'd rather not have the poem be a kind of collaboration between all these sides of myself. I'd rather have the heart of it, at least the thrust of it, come out of one moment, one sitting, one mood.
A lot of your poems have to do with sleep and dreams. Several of your poems end there. Some of your poems are just totally about that. And I'm wondering if sleep is often restful for you.
I'm just lazy is what you're implying. Well, Keats is the great poet of sleep and dreams and drowsiness, which was thought to be a kind of a receptive state of mind. It might be that I just have too much time on my hands. Max Beerbohm once said that the hardest thing about being a poet was knowing what to do with the other 23 and a half hours in the day.
Right. How long are you going to really sit there and write?
That's right.
Yeah. So do you take a lot of naps?
I do when I can, yes. And I think waking up from a nap or from sleep is a very good state in which to think about things to write about and even to begin writing. Before the language of the world has a chance to infiltrate your ears, before you hear the radio or someone else talking or read a newspaper, I think that's a good time to write, because I think language can be fresher in those occasions when you're closer to sleep.
You have a poem called The Night House, which is in part about sleep and the difference between the waking mind and the unconscious mm-hmm. mind, the sleeping mind.
It's a poem. It's kind of a meditation on, another great time to write, of course, is as a response to insomnia. And I suppose the poem is kind of a meditation on insomnia and also a sense that things happen when we're asleep. You know how in those old cartoons like the teapot and all the things in the kitchen come alive, and but this is a sense that the body itself begins to kind of go off in its own directions. Shall I read it?
Please.
The Night House. Every day, the body works in the fields of the world, mending a stone wall or swinging a sickle through the tall grass, the grass of civics, the grass of money. And every night the body curls around itself and listens for the soft bells of sleep. But the heart is restless and rises from the body in the middle of the night, leaves the trapezoidal bedroom with its thick, pictureless walls to sit by herself at the kitchen table and heat some milk in a pan. And the mind gets up too, puts on a robe and goes downstairs, lights a cigarette and opens a book on engineering. Even the conscience awakens and roams from room to room in the dark, darting away from every mirror like a strange fish. And the soul is up on the roof in her nightdress, straddling the ridge, singing a song about the wildness of the sea until the first rip of pink appears in the sky. Then they will all return to the sleeping body, the way a flock of birds settles back into a tree, resuming their daily colloquy, talking to each other or themselves, even through the heat of the long afternoons. Which is why the body, that house of voices, sometimes puts down its metal tongs, its needle, or its pen, to stare into the distance, to listen to all its names being called, before bending again to its labor.
That's a beautiful poem.
Thank you, Terry.
You know, on those nights when you can't sleep, when you do have insomnia, do you panic about life in general?
That nervousness, the anxiety or the coffee or whatever that doesn't let you sleep, is something that makes the pen jitter. I mean, this is the stuff that I think poets, you know, wag their tails over. It is a nervous response. It is a nervous sign that something is, there's some turbulence or some disturbance in your inner life. And for me, one of the functions or one of the beauties of poetry is that it's something to do with your inner life. It's an activity. The writing and the construction of poems is an external activity that brings the inner life out of yourself and gives you a way to deal with it and understand it.
Billy Collins, I love your poems. I want to thank you so much for reading some of them for us. I wish we had time for some more.
The pleasure's been all mine, Terry.
Billy Collins, recorded last year after the publication of his book Picnic Lightning. A new edition of his 1991 book, Questions About Angels, has just been published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, performance poet Sekou Sundiata. He mixes the spoken word with music. And film critic John Powers reviews Bill Murray's new film, Rushmore. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's easy to listen to Sekou Sundiata's poems, like good songs, over and over again because you like the music. Sundiata is one of the performance poets who has attracted a following among many young people who like the rhymes and rhythms of rap. Sundiata often reads with a band behind him and has created several music theater works. He co-founded a record label devoted to spoken word. That label, Mouth Almighty, released his first CD called The Blue Oneness of Dreams. His second CD is recorded but not yet released. It was dropped by its distributor as a result of a corporate merger and subsequent reorganization. However, we have a copy of the recording and want to play an excerpt for you. The CD is called Urban Music. This is called Redemption Poem.
Late some summer night, sitting on a bench in El Barrio in a park we call Mecca. For our devotion to Wawango, Panamanian Ray, Acapulco gold washed down with scuppernong, rounded out the head so nice. Fly shop knits, English leather, Peter Prep, Boogaloo Blues, Oye Pablito, Tiene Bambú. The zen of rolling joints with one hand. And Junior home from Otisville, tipping off to the pier on the East River, with Cecil who played piano in the church. A love supreme, stay in my corner, to be with you, coming through. A love supreme, stay in my corner, to be with you. Coming through the thin speakers, through to the membranes of our hearts. Ritmo sabrosa, something sweet. Dancing so tight up on Joyce from cross town, I was stuck to myself in my sleep. 2 days later, when I dunked for the first time and Walter said, oh yeah, do it again. The ball was our prayer. And Wild Ass T came back screaming Eagles. Santo Domingo, 55 millimeter rounds. Trujillo, the dictator, Vietnam, body bags on the tarmac.
Sekou Sundiata from a not-yet-released CD. I spoke with Sekou Sundiata in 1997 after the release of his first CD, The Blue Oneness of Dreams. You're a poet who uses your voice in, I think, a particularly musical way. And I wonder if you were always reading that way or if you had to find your voice.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the way I present my work has evolved over time, you know, and I've thought about it, you know, in the beginning it wasn't very conscious, really a very conscious development. But as I thought about it over time, I really set about trying to develop a sound and approach that I thought was uniquely mine. I should also say that, you know, in the way that I started writing poetry and got into poetry, I really felt that I was trying to ground myself, first and foremost, in African-American culture. And so my first love in African-American culture was black speech and black music. And really, I think to understand something about black speech and black music, you know, helps anyone understand what's going on in black literature, whether it's fiction, poetry, playwriting, whatever. So for me, it has always been a question of the musicality of language, the musicality of black speech.
Now, when you realized, like, the musicality of speech, you could have gone into acting or even singing, but you wrote. What led you to writing?
Well, you know, I guess once I was in school, I loved to write. You know, I loved to read and I loved to write and I liked books. And I loved music, I tried singing as well, but...
Did you?
Nothing called me, nothing appealed to my imagination as much as writing. I mean, even before I started writing poetry, those times when I was, you know, reading or writing, you know, I discovered that this was a pathway to, you know, a source of great joy for me, a source of great pleasure, which was to be in my imagination, you know, where, you know, where there are no boundaries, where I can imagine anything, that seemed more possible to me as a writer than, you know, let's say, as a musician or as a singer or even an actor.
What were you writing about when you first started to write?
I was making stuff up.
They call it fiction.
Yeah, yeah, right. you know, I recall when I was in school, I would sometimes have to write a book report. Sometimes I would do the book report and do this alternative book report. Let's call it that as well. Sometimes I would just do my alternative book report, which is I would make up a book and I'd make up a title. And, you know, and I'd report on it. And I'd look in the phone book and try and find a name for an author, just a name that sounded right.
Now, your teacher may have called that cheating.
Exactly.
So what kind of books would you make up?
You know, I liked adventure stuff then, you know. I'd make up books about war or about, you know, the frontier or, you know, things like that. And it's interesting, you know, the stuff that I made up was very close to the stuff I was reading, resembled very much the stuff I was reading in school. So I didn't write about my neighborhood and my community yet because I didn't realize that my neighborhood and my community and my life was something you could write about.
How did you realize that it was?
I think towards, going into the 1970s, towards the ends of the 60s, I started hearing poetry by poets who were, you know, already developing at that point, who were writing these poems using, first of all, the kind of vernacular culture and speech that I heard in the community, you know, and wrote about subjects and themes that I felt very close to, that I felt connected to. I think of a poet, Victor Hernandez Cruz, for example, Puerto Rican poet, you know, who wrote about Puerto Ricans in New York, who wrote about, you know, the projects, who wrote about the Lower East Side, which was so, you know, so familiar to me. Or Mary Baraka, you know, who wrote about black music. You know, when I started hearing, you know, music figures showing up in his poetry, like James Brown or John Coltrane, you know, it gave me a whole other look at what was going on around me, what was going on in the culture, and it elevated, in my own eyes, my own culture. So I really feel, you know, in a lot of ways, that poetry and that literature saved my life.
Saved it from what?
Well, you know, I mean, I could have gone in any number of different directions, you know. I tried to be, you know, I tried to be in the streets for a while, you know. I tried, you know, I tried to be the tough guy. I tried to do a lot of that stuff, you know. And really, you know, it wasn't me. You know, it just wasn't my life. But I had nothing else going on instead of that. You know, I went to school and I did fairly well in school and I was sort of interested. I played sports, particularly basketball. And, you know, I was interested in that, and I played okay. But there was nothing really at that point really pulling me and engaging me in such a way that, you know, made me want to say, hey, I really want to, you know, I really want to do this, you know, until I started hearing that poetry and started experimenting with it. And it became a real possibility. And the other part of it is that it gave me a way to connect up to my culture and to black life in a way that I thought was vital. In a way that I thought was really socially engaged, particularly at that time. And that was very important to me, you know, to have some involvement in the struggles and the life and, you know, the mythology of my community and my people.
Since you had tried to be the tough guy but didn't think you were very convincing at that, when you got more interested in writing and particularly in poetry, did you feel you had to, you know, masculinize it in any way? Did it feel like it wasn't either hip enough or masculine enough for
yeah.
you?
See, you know, I mean, the fortunate thing for me is that at that time, something close to what's going on now was happening. You know, right now we're in this sort of revival or of poetry and spoken word. And at that time, it was very popular.
Oh, it's like the Last Poets and Baraka.
Right, right. So you could say you were a poet and be hip.
Right. Revolutionary.
Right. You know. And I was very much involved in the movement at that time. You know, I was an activist. I was a radical. So, you know, all of these things fit, you know. And it made me, you know, it was a way to be cultured and civilized, which is to say a way to be hip.
Were you writing revolutionary poems?
Yeah, I wrote revolutionary poems. I wrote militant poems. I wrote most of my poems in those days were you know, about social issues in the main, you know. And I always had a couple of love poems going. I guess part of that is the inspiration of popular music, you know. I always thought that one of the great songwriters to me whose work was just so poetic was Smokey Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Smokey Robinson, I think, wrote great lyrics, great love lyrics.
I think this would be a good time to hear another one of your poems. I'm going to ask you to do another poem that you also do on your new CD, and the poem is Shout Out. So before you do the poem for us, maybe tell us a little bit about writing it and about, this is a particularly musical kind of poem.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, if I had to describe, you know, a qualifying thing for me as a poet, you know, people say, well, you're a performance poet or whatever. That's not really how I identify myself. I think of myself, if anything, as a ritual poet, meaning that I think of poetry as ritual. I think that is the roots of it, you know, the roots of it in chanting and dance, et cetera, et cetera. So I was really thinking about trying to create a poem that would have a ritual feel to it in the sense of being an opening, an introduction to what is to follow, whether it's, you know, more poems or the set with the band. This is typically how I open a set when I perform with my band, the body of the poem. I'll just also say that, you know, Shout Out is a tradition on radio, particularly on black radio, where basically people call up the radio station and give shout outs. You know, they give a shout out to, you know, my cousin, a shout out to my girlfriend, a shout out to whoever, you know, and it really is just a dedication. I always loved that because it was just a chance for, you know, everyday folk to get access to this mass media, to the airwaves, and make a dedication. So here it is, Shout Out. Here's to the best words in the right place at the perfect time. Here's to 3-hour dinners and long conversations, to the philosophical ramifications of a beautiful day. To the 12 steppers at the 13th step, may they never forget the first step. To the increase, to the decrease, to the do, to the did, to the do, to the did, to the do, to the did, to the done, done. To the lonely, to the brokenhearted, to the new blue haiku. Here's to all or nothing at all. Here's to the sick and the shut in. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to the crazy, the lazy, the bored, the ignored, the beginners, the sinners, the losers, the winners, to the smooth and the cool, and even to the fools. Here's to your ex-best friend, to the rule benders and the repeat offenders, to the lovers and the troublers, the engaging, the enraging, to the healers and the feelers and the fixers and the tricksters, to a star falling through a dream, to a dream when you know what it means, to the bottom, to the root, to the base, boom, to the drum. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to somebody within the sound of your voice this morning. Here's to somebody who can't be within the sound of your voice tonight. To a low cholesterol pig sandwich smothered in sign without the pork. To a light buzz in your head and a soundtrack in your mind going on and on and on and on like a good time. Here's to promises that break by themselves. Here's to the breaks with great promise. Here's to people who don't wait in the car when you tell them to wait in the car. Here's to what you forgot and who you forgot. Here's to the unforgettable. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to the hip-hoppers, the don't-stoppers, heads nodding in the digital glow of their beloved studios. To the incredible, indelible impressions made by the gazes you gaze in the faces of strangers. To yourself you ask, could this be God straight up, or is it a mask? Here's to the tribe of the hyper-cyber, tripping at the virtual-most outpost, at the edge, on the tip, believing that what they hear is the mothership. Drawing near. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found.
That's Sekou Sundiata. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. With poet Sekou Sundiata, I spoke with him in 1997 after the release of his first CD, The Blue Oneness of Dreams. That CD included a recording of perhaps his best-known poem, Blink Your Eyes. Before we played it, I asked him about writing the poem.
Well, there are a couple of things going on in this particular version of it. One is that I wrote the poem really sort of, you know, responding to this well-documented and well-known antagonistic relationship between black and Latino males in particular and the police. So that was one part of it in terms of subject matter. The other part of it was, you know, I teach, and I started getting a number of students a few years back who were coming in to write poetry who were really influenced by hip-hop and really wanted to write in a way that was very different from what I knew and from the way I sort of came up or developed as a writer. And so they really, you know, I guess my reference point for a lot of people I came through with was jazz, people who wrote and tried to use jazz as a reference point. For them, it was hip-hop. So, you know, I tried to write this poem in sort of a dedication to them. Then the other part is a dedication to Sterling Brown, who was many people called the Dean of Black Poetry, and who wrote, I guess, particularly in a so-called folk idiom and in a blues idiom very much. Musically, I don't know. You know, we were sort of finding our way in the studio. We'd done this poem in a number of different ways, and we were really trying to find something fresh to make it sort of new and interesting to us. One of the things that happened is I made a sample and used a sample in this cut, and it's a sample of Sweet Honey in a Rock singing group, singing the blues, Your Worries Ain't Like Mine, which I thought was fitting, given the subject matter of the piece. And then, of course, I thought it should have some sort of drive to it, some sort of driving pulse, some sort of driving beat. You know, so all of those ideas sort of came together to form what we have now.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is the poem Blink Your Eyes from Seiko Sundiata's new CD, The Blue Oneness of Dreams.
I was on my way to see my woman, but the law said I was on my way through a red light, red light, red light. And if you saw my woman, you could understand I was just being a man. It wasn't about no light, it was about my ride. And if you saw my ride, you could dig that too, you dig? Huh? Do you really dig? Sunroof, stereo, radio, radio, sunroof, stereo, radio. Black leather bucket seats sit low. You know the body's cool, but the tires are worn. Ride when the hard times come, ride when they're gone. In other words, Jack, the light was green. I could wake up in the morning without a warning, and my world could change. Blink your eyes, blink your eyes. All depends on the skin, all depends on the skin you live in. All depends on the skin, all depends on the skin you live in. Up to the window come the law with his hand on his gun. What's up, what's happening? I said, I guess that's when I really broke the law. He said a routine, step out the car. He said a routine, assume the position. Hands up in the air, you know the routine, like you just don't care. License and registration. Deep was the night and the light did it deep in the deep was the night from the light from the north star on the car door. I could see deja vu, we've been through this before. Why did you stop me? Somebody, body, 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 somebody had to stop you. I watched the news. You always lose. You're unreliable. That's undeniable. This is serious. You could be dangerous.
People who are into rap really like rhyme. Do you think that that's made it safe to like poetry?
I think so. I think hip-hop rap has really, if there's any single thing I could point to that has led the way and opened the doors for this current revival and this interest in poetry, I think that's been it. If for no other reason than it has prepared people to listen to the spoken word, and then again to the spoken word with music as well.
Now, what's your relationship to rhymes?
My relationship to rhyme.
I mean, do you like working with rhymes? You sometimes do.
Oh yeah, no question. I do. Although I don't set out to rhyme. You know, mm-hmm. I don't. You know, I write pretty much what's called open verse, not free verse, but open verse, where you know the poem really sort of dictates what the form is going to be. But yeah, no, I do like to rhyme. I think of it as a musical device. It's one of the ways I have learned to get to musicality in my writing. I mean, you know, there's certain techniques, rhyming, you know, repetition, use of song forms. I borrow a great deal from music, and from particularly from popular music.
You know, there's a line in Harlem, A Letter Home, that I think so clearly shows the influence of song lyrics on your poems. When you're talking about being at the Apollo Theater and everybody wanting to be kissed the way they say. Why don't you do the line, because I'm just paraphrasing.
We used to be backstage at the Apollo waiting for the stars, begging them to kiss us like they say. You know, it's a funny thing about that is, you know, I guess, you know, people project their own fantasies and dreams onto the lead singer in particular.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I always thought that, you know, that this must be the way they kiss, you know, the way they sing. It must be that beautiful, that compelling. You know?
And now you think?
I you know, it may be true.
Would you ever think when you're reading that people must project that onto you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a power spot, you know, to be in front of the band.
That's right, that's
right.
Yeah,
to be the front man in a band, and you got the microphone and the spotlight, and, mm-hmm. you know, that is a mythic place, especially in American culture, you know. So I think, you know, it has probably less to do with me than the power of the position itself, you know.
Sekou Sundiata recorded in 1997 after the release of his first CD, The Blue Oneness of Dreams. His company, Mouth Almighty, is looking for a new distributor for his already recorded CD, Urban Music. Coming up, John Powers reviews Bill Murray's new movie, Rushmore. This is Fresh Air. Rushmore is a new comedy starring Jason Schwartzman and Bill Murray, who has already gotten awards for his performance from film critics in New York and L.A. Our film critic John Powers has this review.
When you see as many movies as I do, the one thing you're never really prepared for is genuine originality. It's thrilling to be at a movie and suddenly realize that you don't have the slightest idea where it's heading. I've had that thrill only once in the last year. That was when I first saw Rushmore, which pulls off the miraculous feat of being a completely fresh teen comedy. It's not about mean parents, sexual snickering, or being carved up by a psycho. It's about the redemptive power of love and art. Newcomer Jason Schwartzman stars as Max Fisher, a brainy oddball scholarship kid at the prestigious Rushmore Academy, a school he inhabits like a second womb since his actual mother is dead. Max is interested in everything, from beekeeping to student theatricals. But he befriends a man who's no longer interested in anything. That's Herman Bloom, played by Bill Murray, an unhappily married millionaire who bears the psychic scars of Vietnam. The two become spiritual comrades until they both fall for Rosemary Cross, a gorgeous first-grade teacher who's mourning the death of her husband. Suddenly, these three confused souls are caught in a bizarre romantic triangle that spins hilariously, even dangerously, out of control. When Rosemary unexpectedly invites a young male doctor to a dinner celebrating Max's latest play, Max pitches a sulk fit that even includes the waiter.
I just want to thank you for accommodating us. You see, we only thought we were going to be three, but someone invited himself along, so I apologize.
It's quite all right, sir.
Okay.
Very well.
You're being rude, Max.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. I'm just trying to figure out why you brought this gentleman to my play and my dinner, which was invitation only. Would you like me to pass the creamer, Doc?
Yes, please.
What is wrong with you?
What is wrong with you? You hurt my feelings. This night was important to me.
How did I hurt your feelings?
Oh, my God! I wrote a hit play! And I'm in love with you.
This is the second movie by Wes Anderson, the 29-year-old Texan whose debut, the slouchy charmer Bottle Rocket, marked him as a filmmaker to watch. Rushmore shows him to be a major comic talent in the great tradition of Preston Sturges and Ernst Lubitsch. He makes light movies about heavy things. Although all the characters are dealing with emotional wounds, the movie is filled with superb comic bits, be it the middle-aged Herman tiptoeing furtively from tree to tree like Wile E. Coyote, or high school kids putting on Max's play about gangbangers, an oblique send-up of hip 90s movies about teen violence. In fact, there's nothing remotely hip about Anderson and his co-writer Owen Wilson. Their vision of life is playful and innocent, rather than fashionably cynical and dark. They create a magical world in which children act like adults act like kids, and everyone meets on exactly the same level. While there's not a predictable moment in its entire 89 minutes, the movie's freewheeling brio is deceptive. Anderson has engineered everything. The striking widescreen compositions and kindergarten block colors. The anachronistic music by the likes of Chad and Jeremy. The metaphoric use of everything from school blazers and Merlin hats to model airplanes and aquariums. But for all his miniaturist attention to detail, Anderson's style never overwhelms the characters. He gets a dazzling debut from Jason Schwartzman, whose brazenly bespectacled Max isn't merely a triumph of deadpan timing, but an enduring American archetype, the wide-eyed dreamer who's always reinventing himself and the world around him, even if it drives everybody crazy. And more impressively, Anderson wins a beautifully restrained performance from Bill Murray, an incomparable scene stealer whose rueful, pockmarked visage touches us as never before. In a just world, he'd win the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, but I suspect he won't, because the Academy tends to reward ham, not creme brulee. Max's story begins with a stage curtain parting and builds to the production of his most ambitious play, Heaven and Hell, a mock Oliver Stone epic that unites all the characters, male and female, young and old, grumpy and amiable, in a reconciliation scene that's Shakespearean in its euphoria. At a time when comedies are either deliberately moronic, like The Waterboy, or achingly black, like Happiness, Rushmore is a sweet-natured anomaly. Smart, funny, and suffused with optimism, this is the best Hollywood comedy since Groundhog Day. And though it's always risky to say such a thing, it's destined to become an American classic.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Roberta Schirach. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Kathy Wolf. I'm Cherie Gross.
Trees swaying in the summer breeze, showing off their silver leaves as we walked by. Soft kisses on a summer's day, laughing all our cares away, just you and I. Sweet sleepy warmth of summer.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture, and Little Brown and Company, publishers of Tom Jones' collection of short stories, Sonny Liston Was a Friend of Mine, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Kissinger transcripts. We talk with Tom Blanton, director of the National Security Archive. The archive obtained previously classified transcripts of Henry Kissinger's secret Cold War negotiations with Chinese and Soviet leaders. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.